I am Planta on the line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Carol Off joins me now. The award-winning and best-selling author has a new book out, All We Leave Behind, A Reporter's Journey into the Lives of Others. It's a remarkable memoir about the bond between her and a family from Afghanistan. She interviews Asad Arubwal as part of an award-winning report on the Afghan conflict, where he places himself in danger as he describes the exploits of the warlord, General Abdul Rashid Dostum, whose payroll Assad had been on. She interviews Assad again in 2006, and after that, Carol finds out that he and his family's lives are in danger. Ms. Off must now confront her own part in the family's crisis, and as they're forced to flee, she looks critically at the work of a journalist. She also recounts in the book the harrowing experiences of the Arab Walls and the years of navigation they and Carol must do of the refugee system that eventually sees their arrival in Canada. Carol Off is the host of CBC Radio's As It Happens. She has won numerous awards for her television reporting around the world. She is the author of three previous best-selling books, The Lion, The Fox, and The Eagle, The Ghosts of Medic Pocket, and Bitter Chocolate, Investigating the Dark Side of the World's Most Seductive Sweet. This new book is published by Random House. Please welcome to the Plant Online program in Toronto today, Carol Off. Ms. Off, good morning.
Good morning. Hello.
Thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
At the core of this book, and this is my read of it, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong, is the fact that asking questions, whether you're a journalist as you are or someone who's helped people as you have, that's the core of life, isn't it? And I mean, I'm curious to know what answers did you come up in the course of writing this book in terms of your work and who you are?
I think that the most important thing I learned in the course of the story that the book tells and writing it is that everything comes with consequences and everything comes with responsibilities, and that we have to understand the consequences of questions and things we report on, and we have to take responsibility for them. So I can ask questions and get people to tell me things, but then I'm responsible for that. I'm the custodian of those answers, and in many ways I am someone who has to respect and take care of the person who gave it to me. And that's what I learned more than anything else, that I have to take responsibility for the interviews, the questions I asked, and the answers that they give me.
So did you not think of that before?
I did, but I didn't know to the degree it was necessary, and or that the degree to which people do put their lives in your hands sometime. I knew that I had to protect people. I've disguised identities. I've disguised their faces or their voices. But I think that I rarely looked back afterwards to see what had happened after cameras are gone or you hung up the phone. And I think that's what I learned, is that quite often it's sometime later where the consequences actually hit home. So that's the biggest part of it. But I also didn't know that, you know, the degree to which people are willing to tell you things that may not be in their best interest because they hope it makes a difference. That people feel, especially if they're living in a dictatorship or an authoritarian state or whatever, they want to change things. They're idealistic. They want to get the word out. They think it will make a difference if they tell me things and they get the story out. And so they're willing to take enormous risks and to show enormous courage. So you can't, even if you think, well, you know, I think they'll be okay. They've said that they've covered for themselves. They've made all kinds of moves to ensure that they're somewhat safe. I know to a greater degree the risks people are willing to take to tell you things, and I have to take responsibility for that.
And so I guess the lesson here for anybody is that you do have to ask questions, but you also have to think about, you know, just the sort of questions you have to ask. Do you wonder though whether there are journalists like you who are conscious? I mean, it's an odd question, but you know, when they do these surveys amongst people, lawyers come out a little worse than journalists. But you know, journalists are sort of near the bottom in terms of trustworthiness amongst the public. Do you think there are journalists who do burn sources, who do put people's lives in danger by the work that they do?
Oh, for sure. Oh, for sure there are people who do that. Oh, yes, they are those who will do anything for a story that it advances their own career. Absolutely. I think more than that, I mean, I think the majority of people I know are very conscious of the effect they have. But, you know, in the end, people, they're out there on assignment. They're supposed to get the story. They're supposed to come back with the goods. And especially if you're in a dicey situation, a war zone or whatever, you don't have a lot of time. You got to get in there and get out before things turn pear-shaped. And so you can be blind to a lot of things because you just have to get it. You have to get the material. And so everyone is under pressure to work very quickly. And so those are the times when you maybe are not as aware of the effect it might have. Then there are those who just don't care. And I've met lots of those on the road. And they are, you know, much loathed and despised, and we all make note of them.
Yeah.
And we warn people against talking to them. But they're often people with the biggest resources
and
and a lot of them are paying people, and it can be pretty ugly out there. There's a small group, I think, that make a bad name for the rest of us.
Yeah. So it was 2002, that's when you first encountered Assad, is that right?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, and so what was his role in terms of, what was the work that he was doing that you in terms encountered him?
Assad at the time, Assad Ariabwal was just, at that point, a businessman, as he'd been most of his life. But he had been, for a time, conscripted into one of the warlord's militia, one of the most notorious warlords in Afghanistan, who would force people in the city, in this community, into military service with the fear of death if they didn't. And they would be, they threatened their children with abduction and, you know, horrible consequences. They threatened to kill you if you didn't join. So he took part in this militia against his will. But he was a logistics guy. He had to go and gather supplies and everything and help supply this warlord's militia, which was a standing army, a personal army of 60,000, by the way.
Yeah.
So he had a lot of knowledge about how this guy operated. And he wasn't, I mean, there were a lot of people who knew how this particular warlord operated and how notorious and how evil he was. But the thing is, there weren't many people who were willing to talk about it. And so this was a man who believed that that he could maybe make a difference because the Canadians were there, the Americans were there, all these foreign forces, NATO had arrived, and maybe it's possible with all of these people wanting to do something and to get rid of the Taliban and to make the country a better place, that maybe this is a really good time to try and get rid of these horrible warlords as well. And so he was willing to talk about them, and we interviewed him and did a really good story that he helped us to get and got access to others as well. And, and then that was great. I had got my story, and I left.
Did he do bad stuff himself?
No, he didn't. And I checked that out because I wanted to make sure.
Yeah.
And no, he wasn't. This warlord did some pretty awful things, and he had the men he had under, who were his fighters, his combatants. They were people who not only would they go and do whatever killing was necessary, but they were allowed as a kind of payment to pillage and take whatever they want and rob people and steal from them take and confiscate their property. So they were kind of a hardcore center of it. A lot of these other people, like Assad, were those who had to do functioning roles. And everyone had to take a role, otherwise, you were toast.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I pretty thoroughly checked it out, and so did the United Nations, you know, that he wasn't involved in any combatant role.
Yeah. So you meet him again in 2006. I guess you're doing a follow-up for your work. Did he, at that time in 2006, did he let on as to the difficulties he and his family were facing?
He did not. In 2006, I wanted to do an update. And, in 2002, when we did the first interview, he and I both believed that this was a really opportune time, a possible time when things could make a difference in this interview, which could really be effective. But 2006, it was pretty obvious that the warlords were on the payroll of the CIA and the State Department. U.S. taxpayers and Canadian taxpayers were paying to support these warlords, and they weren't going anywhere. So when I interviewed Assad again in 2006, I wanted to see if he thought anything had changed, and it hadn't. He didn't tell me that the warlords' guys had already come to see him and told him that, as a first warning, you know, first of all, you could never go back to the north. You could never go back to these parts of these territories, and if you do, you'll be killed. Mm-hmm. And you better just, you know, mind your P's and Q's and not do any more of these interviews with media. He didn't tell us that. And had he told me that in 2006, I never would have interviewed him again.
Yeah. And at what point is it that you find out sort of the consequences of him talking to you? Was that when you see him 2 years later in Pakistan?
Yeah, I hadn't. I kept in touch with his daughter, his oldest daughter, who could speak English, and she was just a wonderful, wonderful young girl, woman. Yeah. And we just kept in touch, and then she stopped responding to emails for a while, and I thought, oh, she's just moved on with her life. Then I was in Pakistan to cover the death of Benazir Bhutto, and learned through her that they were living in exile, that they'd had to flee into Pakistan because the warlord was said after 2006 interview, look, now you're dead, you're toast. We are sending death squads to take care of you, and unless you leave, go into exile, go anywhere you want, but you can never come back to Afghanistan again. And so he had fled the country, and that's when I learned I was in Pakistan, where he had sought refuge. I found out he was living there in exile with nobody, with no money, with no try to take care of his five kids and his wife, and completely on his own.
And so what do you think at that point?
Yeah, I had a whole bunch of emotions. My first was like, when I met with him and I learned the story, and I learned this was the consequences of the interviews we had done and the documentaries I had done. And my first reaction was like, I was horrified that this had been the consequences. A part of me was angry because I asked him, you must have known. Why did you agree to do these interviews? You must have known there'd be consequences. And he told me, well, because if I hadn't told you the truth, I could never look into the eyes of my children again. And, at that point, when I started to see him, I saw the full man and how much integrity and he had, and this is a guy who had a higher moral order than most of us.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized, this is a man, I can't leave him behind. I can't leave him to face these consequences. I'm going to have to try and do something.
And you do, and you do your part, I should say, in terms of helping them get out of there and come to Canada. But about his, you mentioned his wife and his five kids. I mean, they're remarkable people in and of themselves. I mean, the Assad and his wife, their marriage is unique, isn't it?
Yeah, it's unique in so many ways. And
yeah.
His clan, and this is a guy, this is a sophisticated family. These aren't people in farm areas without education. But they were very conservative, and they expected that Assad should marry someone from their own clan. And he fell in love with a woman who was from outside of their sphere, a beautiful, charming, funny, sexy woman who was a teacher, who was his teacher. She wore short skirts. She had all this, just absolute charm and everything. And he was smitten. His family was horrified and did some horrible things to him and his wife to punish him for that. So he had married this exceptional woman. He had children and daughters whom he educated. His own family didn't educate their women and girls. And so he believed, and his wife believed, in education, the power of a really good universal education. So the kids were all enrolled in schools. Mom worked. She wasn't home all the time. It was a typical kind of Canadian family. It would be like, something so common here. But in Afghanistan, it was very unusual. And the kids all, of course, were exceptional in their own right, especially, the oldest daughter who became and has remains a very good friend of mine. She was just such a an incredible live wire, and she was so bright. She, when the Taliban was pushed out and she could go back to school as a girl, she had the best marks in all of Afghanistan, and her sister Hosai had the best marks in all of Afghanistan after her, the next grade. They were so smart, so ambitious, so full of energy. And so, yes, in all respects, it was an unusual family.
And so have you talked to them as to why they trusted you so much as they have?
They trusted me because they had no choice. I was their only hope, and Assad made that clear when I saw him that time in Pakistan, when I'd learned what had happened, and when he told me, I had to tell you the truth, that his family had abandoned him because he had messed up as far as they were concerned. He'd married badly, and his children were doing things wrong. His daughter had won a scholarship to study in Paris for a month, and he'd sent her off to do that and without an escort. And now he associated with this foreign journalist from Canada, this woman he let straight, you know, my cameraman into his house, strange men were, you know, he had, as far as they were concerned, he had humiliated the family's honor. And so they wouldn't help him. Yeah. And so he had no family to turn to. So, and he had no money, he had no resources. I was it. He told me, you know, if you don't help me, I have no one.
And so what are the internal discussions that you have with yourself, your family, people around you, as to whether or not you help?
Well, I had, you know, first of all, it's as a journalist, you don't get involved in your stories. That's the code. But at the same time, I thought, well, this is part of the story. This is part of my job, I think, because he's done this. This is an interview with CBC. This is a man who was, you know, gave a testimony to the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. He thought he was warning Canadians. He thought he was helping the Canadian mission. You know, I thought, well, this is an extension of my job, is to try and help him. But as I got deeper and more involved in it, I realized that, no, I've crossed the line here, and I'm very much involved in this life, and I'm not here as a journalist. I'm just here as a person. And so those are some of the internal conversations. But the initial one was that I just have to get this guy out of this mess.
Yeah. And when you look back at it all, knowing what the last several, I guess 15, 17 years or so, do you wonder now, if knowing what you know and what's happened to this guy and his family, would you talk to him initially, 2002?
Well, I definitely would have talked to him the first time, because we both thought it was the right thing to do, and it just seemed like it really felt that change was in the air, and this is the country that he wanted to live in, which was a modern Afghanistan, not the one that his family wanted to live in, which was very traditional, not the one the Taliban wanted to live in, which was, you know, oppressive, not the one the warlords wanted, which was corrupt and criminal.
Yeah.
He thought, well, the NATO is here, Canadians are here, Americans are here. This is an opportunity to get this country right, to put it back on the rails. And so he was very optimistic. I was optimistic. I thought it was good. So, I don't regret the first interview. I don't regret the first story we did. I don't know if I could have found out more about the consequences then. He didn't tell me. I can't fault him for that. He didn't tell me, he says, because he figured that I wouldn't do the interview, which is true.
Yeah.
And he wanted to get his message out. And he thought he could... I think he's such an optimist. I think he thought he could still beat the odds, that they really weren't serious. They weren't seriously banish him from his country or kill him. He couldn't believe that was possible. So he was willing to take the risk again without... But he knew that I probably wouldn't do the interview, or he just wondered, you know, he decided not to tell me for a whole bunch of reasons, I guess. And then I often think, you know, because I don't regret it in the sense that I have this extraordinary group of people who are my friends, who live here now, whom I see all the time, we hang out.
Yeah.
I wouldn't know them if we hadn't gone through this, but that's hardly a consolation prize for what I put them through.
Yeah, and so I mean, this also opens up another field of inquiry in terms of If in 2006 you wouldn't have talked to him again, what are some of the situations that journalists encounter when covering, war zones and difficult situations? I mean, are there stories that aren't coming out, I guess?
I think that a lot of stories just simply don't come out because it's too dangerous for the journalists. It's too dangerous for everybody. And that's the situation. That's the atmosphere of terror and dread and danger that authoritarian regimes try to create in order to prevent stories from being told. I mean, they've shut down the journalism in their own countries. They kill the journalists. They lock them up. They threaten them. In all kinds of countries where we have relationships with, Turkey, a NATO partner, and there's hundreds of journalists in jail in Turkey. So they, in their own countries, try to shut down the stories. And so journalists from other countries, from Western countries like ours, go to do those stories and find out what's happening to those people. And the same thing, they try to shut those down as well by threatening the people who talk to us with all kinds of consequences. So, we have to realize that these stories have to be told. We have to get this out. But, the risks are enormous for everybody.
Now, the book also navigates your journey and Assad's family's journey through the system to get to Canada. When you hear people say, that the door should be closed to refugees, or they express their fear of refugees coming to this country, what do you think? What do you make of that?
The claim is that somehow we have this welcome mat to the world, and people wander in here willy-nilly, and we can't be the world's doormat. We can't let people in if they're bringing danger with them. If they knew how difficult it is to get here, how incredibly difficult, how bureaucratic it is, how many hoops and obstacles you have to get through, how many screening processes go on, how many years it takes to go through the process, which was, in our case, 8 years. Mm-hmm. When you go through that, you realize that, you can't make the claim that people are just getting in any way they can. But what happens is, because the system makes it so difficult for legitimate refugees to get here, to get someplace, to get to safety, and these are desperate people whose families and lives are in danger.
Yeah, these aren't criminals and people that are going to bring crime to this country, right?
No, they're not terrorists. They're fleeing terrorism. And we make it so difficult for them to get here that they will take any route that they can, including getting into rubber dinghies to cross the Mediterranean or walk across Europe or walk across the Quebec border, because they're desperate. And the legitimate process is so cumbersome and so strewn with obstacles that they'll do anything they can to get out of the trouble they're in.
And as a journalist, you covered the refugee crisis on in your work, and then at the same time you're going through it with this family trying to bring them here. You obviously have some insight as to how this could be fixed, the system.
Well, I think that I think there are a lot of things that could happen. I think that this privately sponsored refugee system that we have for the Syrians, like where there are all these families and communities
churches
sponsored these Syrians. It's an excellent program. I've seen, since I've been quite involved with refugees since their family came here and the whole process of coming here, it's a really good program. And they could expand it many times over and with great success, because those people are wonderful. I mean, the family, I love this, my family, my Afghan family, but I mean, they're no different than all the other families that are trying to get here. There are millions of people like this that are quite wonderful, and we can't let them all in, but we could let a large number of them in. And my family is already paying income tax. They're employed. They're doing jobs. They've started a business. That's what you bring to the country. So I think that they could, make a broader program for refugees. The screening is ridiculous. I think the screening is instead of what people think is that they're not being screened enough, I think they're over-screened. I think it's over-analyzed. They could definitely accelerate that. Most of that's the files are just sitting on desks in many cases, for years, and not even being looked at. That's not a process, That's obstruction. And so to pretend that somehow we're letting the refugees in and we have this thing, well, yeah, you could. They could do these screening processes for health and security much, much faster and get people on the move and get them out of these horrible situations they're in.
So I've seen a couple of the news stories where a couple of the papers, I guess Globe and Mail and the Toronto Star, have interviewed this family, interviewed you for the book. I heard you on The Current recently with the eldest daughter. They all talk about what you've meant to them. Without them, do you wonder what your life would have been?
Well, it embarrasses me when they talk about, you know, what I've done for them, because mm-hmm. they forget what I did to them. And so I don't feel that I did anything heroic or exceptional here. I just had to take my responsibility. I'm the one that got them into that mess. I was the one that had to get them out. And I think that I could have just done that, and my obligation could have ended at the airport when they arrived and said, I'm glad you're here,
yeah.
Have a nice life. But I have continued to be close to them, and they're so much part of my life. You know, I can't imagine them not being in my life. You know, I will watch those kids get married and have their own kids. I'll watch them have lives in Canada. I'll watch them with much interest, how their careers go, their ambitions, their desires, their hopes, their dreams. It's, you know, I have my own family, and now I have this other family, and I can't imagine my life without them now.
What do they make of what's happening in Afghanistan today?
They're very distressed by what's happening in Afghanistan, because it's actually worse than it was before 9/11. I mean, this is... The Taliban has retaken the majority of the country. You know, the cities are probably still held by NATO and the American forces, but everything else has been taken over by the Taliban. The warlords are stronger than ever. They're all on the payroll of Western countries, and the warlord that threatened to murder my friend mm-hmm. and drove him out of the country, he's the vice president of Afghanistan, for goodness sake. And he's on the payroll of, you know, the State Department and the U.S. Treasury. So, you know, the warlords are more powerful than ever. They're just criminals. They're not doing anything to advance the cause and democracy and rights in the country. They're just crooks. They're criminals, and they're on the payroll of the U.S. Treasury. The Taliban has retaken huge swaths of territory and have started their own tyranny in those places. And there are more refugees leaving than there has been in decades. They're all heading out to wherever they can, and what the biggest travesty, I think, for the country is that the best and the brightest have left, like yeah. this family. These are educated, Western-minded, people with vocations and careers and skills, and they're like people like them who are able to leave. They've all left the country.
Yeah.
And so the drain of intelligence and education and professionalism that's left Afghanistan is staggering. So the best and the brightest have left. Yeah, they see that, and they're just in despair for what's happened. I mean, they're happy to be in Canada,
yeah.
And they'll thrive here, but they're just so sad about what's happened to their country.
Yeah. You've been at As It Happens for, is it 10 years or 11 years now?
I've started my 12th year.
12th year. Do you miss the journalism out of the country that you did before hosting As It Happens?
Everyone warned me when I took the job 12 years ago, and they said, Carol, you're going to be so unhappy. You're not a house cat. You know, you're an outdoor cat. You're just... And I was worried. I thought, this is going to be too much of an adjustment. I've never, ever been indoors. I've always been out. I've always been all around the world doing whatever. And I think for the first 6 months it was a real shock to my system. And then after that I just realized that this is extraordinary opportunity to get a lot of stories out that I could never do, you know, going country to country. I can cover the world in a week and follow up on stories. And And also, I think I'll be biased here. It's a great show, and people are really engaged with it, and it's very satisfying to work on a show where that people appreciate so much.
You'll permit me one sort of indulgent question. A lot of people I know love the theme song. Even people that don't listen to the show love the theme song. What's it like for you to sit there and as you're starting the show and hearing that? I mean, do you get sick of it at all?
Okay, I'll tell you very honestly. When I hear the theme music, I hear ice cubes going into a glass because I know that I'm 90 minutes away or from home and a scotch on the rocks, which is my end of the day thing. So for me, I hear that and it's like, yes, because, we do the interviews, so many of them in advance because we have to hit all these time zones. So we go live on the air at 5:30 to the East Coast. Me and Jeff, and we go, hello, we're here, hello, and we start the show, and the theme music comes up, and I'm thinking, okay, my job is actually mostly done at that point because the interviews are done. We just have to do the live portion, and then usually at about 6:15, I can leave, and then he says, I'll pre-tape the goodbyes, and then Jeff has the few remaining interviews to do before the 7 o'clock is the end of the show. So at about 6:15, I can head home and put my feet up.
Yeah. I've been a fan and an admirer of your work for many years, and this book is such a beautiful book in many places that it's been such a pleasure to talk to you. Say hi to Lyndon for me, would you?
I will do that, Joe. Thank you so much.
The book is called All We Leave Behind, A Reporter's Journey into the Lives of Others. It's published by Random House. It's author Carol Off of CBC Radio's As It Happens. Join me on the line from Toronto and Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.